From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codenamed Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. It's Thursday, which means it's time for our weekly listener mail segment. And we're going some strange places today. We are so glad that you're joining us on this journey, this sojourn into stories from the best part of the show, your fellow listeners. But before we get started, guys, there was something I needed to reiterate off air, but I wanted to ask you all about it just while we're rolling, and for all our listeners as well. I think I mentioned before, they found me. I got jury duty. Did I tell you guys that?
Oh, no. Mm-hmm. You actually got it?
Not yet. The audition is tomorrow. I don't know if I'm supposed to call it an audition.
Got it. Yeah, I had one not too long ago, and I, you know, was just assured no one ever gets picked. I mean, obviously, some people get picked, but I totally got picked. And I actually kind of, I think I swayed the jury. I kind of felt like I did my civic duty. And please don't ask me to do it again for another, like, 5 years. But, Ben, Godspeed, sir, and I hope you don't get picked.
I'm into it. I like the validation. You know what I mean? Like, you get picked for jury duty. You're a peer, officially.
It's totally appropriate for the show. I actually, you know, they always ask, how do you get out of jury duty? And you definitely don't want to be caught trying to get out of jury duty, because that's totally illegal. But I answered a question very bluntly. They ask you these jury questions, and it was something like, do you think you could be, you know, completely objective about a case? And I said something to the effect of, well, I do a lot of conspiracy podcast stuff and a lot of true crime, and I kind of feel like the government and, you know, lawyers are all inherently corrupt, and I just don't feel as though I could be completely objective. And it sounds like they picked me because of that, because
they
chose me for that. It's very strange,
because you know, they want honest answers. You know, we'll get to the show, but real quick, I know a lot of us listening today are possibly screaming at their phones, Ben, tell them you believe in jury nullification. It's a real thing, but the issue with that is, if you come in too hot on jury selection and they know you're like pranking them or something, they do not respond well. So I will see if I can be our man on the inside of the justice system. But also, Matt, Noel, the reason I'm bringing this up today is because it makes me think that we are long overdue for an episode on trial by jury. It's got a lot of problems here in the U.S.
That's great. Yeah, it becomes one of the primary focuses in a lot of true crime content. Exactly how a trial by jury functions, what the problems are, and, well, sometimes potential ways to fix it. But it's a complicated issue and something I'd love to delve into deeper with you guys.
Yeah, let's absolutely do that. But before we do, or as we're planning that, we'd love to hear your stories about jury duty, going well, going wrong, your thoughts. You know, we do have legal professionals in the audience today as well. So let us know, conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com. You can also call us 1-833-STDWYTK. Today, we are going to hear from some people who have had their own personal experiences, not with jury duty, but with things they cannot necessarily explain. We're going to visit folklore, philosophy, veterinary science. That felt right. We're not actually going to do that part. And then we're going to visit controversial medicine. So, Matt, what do you say? What do you say we begin with this really interesting story that you hipped us to?
Yes, Ben, we are heading over to a message from Renell. Here we go. Renell says, hi, guys and lady. Shout out to Doc Holliday over there. I came across your podcast last year in the early days of work from home boredom and was immediately hooked. I've always been interested in unexplained and weird events, but stayed away from the outlandish theories, so thank you for continuing to create fascinating content in a thoughtful and entertaining manner. It's very sweet. I have a story that I've been debating sending to you that happened to me a few years ago. My grandparents used to own property on a lake off the Gunflint Trail in northern Minnesota, where I spent a considerable amount of my summers as a kid. There's no cell phone service, and it's not unusual to go days without seeing another person, even out on the lake. The cabin had an upper-level sunroom and deck overlooking the woods down to the lake. This is very important for the rest of the story. Upper-level sunroom and a deck overlooking the woods down to the lake. My grandpa used to sit out on the deck at night and would tell us stories about the glowing fairies that he used to see while he was out there. He later told us he had occasionally seen them pass through the windows and into the cabin. We mostly attributed this to the whiskey sodas he would drink out on the deck in the evenings. That's kind of funny, Rennell. Grandpa enjoyed his whiskey, but Rennell continues here. My grandpa unfortunately passed away in early 2016, and I went to visit him one last time in July 2016 with my mom and my grandma before she put the cabin up for sale. It was the night of July 3rd, and my grandma had already gone to sleep. The evening was clear. There were no electrical storms that night or in the forecast. My mom and I were in the sunroom. Remember, that's the upstairs sunroom area. We had turned off all the lights except for one over the sink in the adjacent kitchen when we started to see what appeared to be fireflies at the tree line outside. Now, this is an ellipsis here. I have never seen fireflies up there before or after. The greenish-white lights started to pulse in time with each other, speeding up, and then suddenly they all went dark, and a roughly grapefruit-sized sphere lit up near the ground. It hovered for a short period, moving slowly upwards. Then it started to gain speed and quickly moved up to the level of the deck, and then it flew very fast over the roof and was gone. Whoa. Right? That was me, by the way. Whoa. Between first seeing the sphere light up and it being gone was maybe only 5 seconds or so, and shortly after it disappeared, the light above the sink dimmed briefly. Okay, there's a little bit more to this email. I kind of want to save it for a second as we discuss some of this. What does that sound like to you guys? Some firefly-looking lights down by the lake, viewing it from a higher above angle, then all of a sudden those lights going away and a larger sphere light being illuminated and then rising up and over the roof. What do you guys think?
Could be any number of things at this point.
Will-o'-the-wisp, perhaps.
Okay.
Remember those?
Okay. I got you. Yeah, all right.
I'm not sure. Certainly opportunities for optical illusions in that situation, but could be something more.
Especially with the water.
Agreed. The water makes a big difference right there because of possible reflections, possible all kinds of other optical illusions that could be happening. But there's also something in there about ball lightning, which is a really weird phenomena that occurs. And it's a real thing. It's not a made up thing. But again, she already mentioned there's no electrical storm, so that weirded me out a little bit. So let's continue in the email here. If my mother hadn't been there and seen the same thing, I would think I was mistaken or confused about what I saw. She grew up in Illinois, and there has been ball lightning before, but swears this was a different thing. There's a pole out in the front of the cabin where the phone and electrical line comes in, which is in the direction that the sphere flew towards. The whole area is composed of bedrock and magnetite, so the only reasonable explanation we've been able to come up with is some sort of, what is this, piezoelectric effect, which could possibly explain the light dimming afterwards. So right there, there's the story. Rennell attached some pictures to this message for us, which actually shows the cabin out there in the middle of the woods, and it also shows the vantage point from that upper-level deck where the sunroom is, overlooking the dock down there by the lake. And I thought this was a really interesting story. I don't know. I mean, I don't even know what else to say about it besides the concept of the grandfather associating these lights that he had seen before in the past with fairies, with being some kind of magical being that exists out there in the woods by the lake. And I don't know. I wanted to look up the folklore. I was thinking about you guys when I was looking some of this stuff up. There is fey folklore within the United States. And I don't know a ton about it. I know that some of it originates from indigenous peoples that lived on this land before, you know, the United States was ever a thing or ever a glint in the eye of some revolutionary. And there's some really fascinating stuff that I've never heard of. And I think it might be worth a full episode to go over some of the, I don't know, fae in the USA. That sounds, sure. Wow, I can't believe I just said that.
Why? That was brilliant. No, it's true though. I think of, you know, when I think of fairy folk, I think of Midsummer Night's Dream and more contemporarily, a lot of Neil Gaiman's work or Sandman in particular. There's a lot of fairies that play serious roles in that work. And also in Pan's Labyrinth, the fairies are kind of creepy and have like sharp, nasty teeth. I kind of was into that depiction. But all of these obviously places not set in the United States.
Well, there's an interesting aspect here, just to interject for a second, because what we see, it's similar to the evolution of abduction stories, right? Where there were changelings, there were alleged hidden sentient groups that would take humans for one reason or another, maybe to go bowling with them, like in the Rip Van Winkle story, or maybe to steal their children. Mm. And then later, with the evolution of UFOs and aliens in the zeitgeist, those stories remain the same, but they just got new things mad-libbed in. So what to me is what's fascinating about this is I love the point you're bringing up regarding pre-European American folklore or folklore on this continent, because those stories and those sorts of beings exist in pretty much every culture. And it's something that I think would be very interesting for those of us in the crowd today who consider themselves extremely skeptical. You have to ask yourself, why was there never an entirely skeptical community that developed independently? But instead, there is a clear line of a clear correlation. Virtually every community has created some sort of story or explanation or narrative or mythology about these events, from, you know, fae-like creatures like brownies to elves to the translation across the world will often be something like the hidden folk. And it's strange. It's strange,
like the littles,
how common they are.
Remember the littles, like, or the borrowers, the little people that live in your walls and stuff? I always enjoyed those stories.
Yes. And this is what I wanted to bring up there. I was reading about Cherokee legends, folklore from specifically the Cherokee tribe. Part of their mythology includes a race of immortal spirit people that feels very similar to fairies. I don't know how similar, at least according to some of the light reading I was doing on the subject. I think they're called Nunahi. I don't know how to pronounce it correctly, but they are, it's translated as the people who live anywhere or the people who live forever. And it's a completely different race of being. It's a completely different subset of being. It's not a god. It's not, you know, a human. It's not a spirit, like a nature spirit or anything like that. It's not a ghost. It's none of these things. It's this other living, intelligent creature that exists.
Kind of like Jin, almost.
Very much so, right? Like just created from some different material. Rather than clay or, you know, like man was, or a smokeless fire like the Jinn.
Do they have any kind of ill intent associated with them in the folklore? I know often spirits like that are malevolent, or are they kind of neutral?
I honestly don't know enough yet. I just started learning about these mythical creatures. And it does change. The way they're described does change depending on which region you're in. But right. The Appalachian Mountains, that's one of the main connective tissues for many of the stories. But there are also stories, a lot of them, surrounding fae-like creatures near the Great Lakes of the U.S.
And this brings us back to something fascinating about your experience, Rennell, when you mention piezoelectric, the phenomenon of piezoelectricity. I think all of our eyes lit up. Piezoelectricity, just to be clear for anyone, the quick and dirty explanation of that is the idea that certain materials can create an electric charge when they have certain types of stress applied to them. So it is, I think, a very reasonable explanation. Maybe it could explain something that, or optical illusions could explain something about what's going on with the Great Lakes. But as we said, these stories are very old. They're also universal. As longtime listeners know, I have roots of a sort in Appalachia, and I can confirm that these things, to your question, Noel, are not, it's like the jinn are considered individuals, first and foremost. They might be Christian, they might be atheists, they might follow Islam. The Nuhei are similar, or beings like that are similar, in that they have human relationships with them are often kind of defined as if-then. So they're supposed to be really friendly to the Cherokee in that folklore, but they're in general friendly to lost wanderers. So overall, they're very very Appalachian in attitude, I would say. They'll have nice. You over. They'll have you over.
Yeah, that's great. There's a book I want to get our hands on called Native American Legends of the Great Lakes and the Mississippi Valley. It's written by Catherine Berry Judson, and it looks like there's a free version of it. Oh, no, it's just a preview. But there's a version of it on archive.org, so I want to actually get a physical copy if possible. The only problem is, I think it was published in, 1914.
We can find it.
I don't know. We'll see. Or if you got one, send it our way. Or at least tell us where to find it. But yeah, I just want to say thanks, Ronell, for sending that in. That was a great story. It sounds like you sold the cabin, I guess, so maybe you won't be able to experience this particular vantage again to see something down there, but who knows? That's that area over there, Gunflint Trail. It's on Lake Superior. It looks really fascinating. It's right at the edge of Canada and the United States, inside the United States. Really cool. So thanks so much. We'll be right back with another message from you.
And we have returned. We have not returned unaccompanied. We're bringing Amy with us on air. Amy, here's what you said. Amy wrote in to say, "Hi, my name is Amy, and the name can be used. About 10 years ago, when I was still kind of young and had done some dumb stuff, a doctor came to me in the hospital room and asked if I would participate in a treatment that would stimulate my heart rate, among other things, while I was asleep. Of course, I said yes, because who doesn't want the benefits of exercising while sleeping? Amy, you put in a question mark and two exclamation points, which I feel is appropriate in that situation. It's the only thing in my mind that would redeem sleep in general." That's me editorializing. On with the story. "Only on the morning of this treatment," says Amy, "while wires were being secured to my forehead, did I realize that this was electroshock treatment. I thought of it as something from the 19th century and didn't even realize it was still a thing, but it sure was. And it was every bit as creepy as imagined. A small room full of rhythmically beeping machines, restraints, the dark of early dawn, the only time when the anesthesiologist was available for this, and the final command to, quote, count backward from 10. With tooth guard in place, eyes kept shut, and mask in place, then waking a couple hours later in a different room with people asking you where you are and what year it is." Now, pause here for a second for you guys. Have you ever been in a situation, maybe post-surgery or something, where you woke up and someone has to give you like a cognitive evaluation?
Thankfully, no, but it terrifies me. I've never actually been put under. Never had a surgery, an invasive surgery.
I had a bad experience with with a then legal substance that gave me a really bad trip. And when I came to, I had to be reoriented to all consciousness. It was bad.
Yeah, to come back from being a particle of a interconnected universe that is only learning to know itself further and more intimately. And you had to get back to the flesh bag, right?
I was a pixel inside an ever-rotating grid, and I was trying to find my way to the center, but I didn't understand what center was. It was bad.
There is no center. You know what I mean?
Center definitely could not hold, that's for sure.
Yeah. Shout out to Yates and Achebe. But the reason I ask is because anybody who's been through this knows it's an enormously disconcerting feeling. And I'm not going to say their name on air because this story perhaps does not paint them in the best light. But my favorite version of this is a friend of mine got into a pretty serious accident a number of years ago, car accident. And this is a guy who was kind of off the grid, kind of unplugged. He's the kind of guy who wouldn't have consented to go to a hospital if he were conscious. And he got that, you know, that assessment, light, flashlight in your eyes, you know, let's check dilation, blah, blah, blah. And they asked him who the president was, and he had no idea. And his family had to explain, like, look, he's a little weird. He didn't know before he got hit by a car. He's just not tuned in. So you have to be careful what kind of questions you ask. That's why people ask what year it is. It's something most people know. Back to Amy. Amy, you said, now about 10 years later, I'm fine, healthy, have gainful employment, a nice home, friends, and a good life where I can do whatever I want while listening to podcasts after work. I don't know whether this procedure contributed or not. There's a lot of controversy about it, I know, and even as a recipient of this treatment, I'm on the fence. I don't remember a lot of things it would seem like I'd remember. Most good, but some bad. And it's kind of spooky to be told about these events by friends and family with no recollection. I can't help but think that I just matured and chilled out, and that the ECT wasn't necessary at all. Still, others swear by it, yet even as a recipient, I wonder if it has any more basis than it did in the 19th century. This is a weird one. We were talking a little bit off air, and Amy, I think at least a few of us agree with that kind of mental image you have when you first hear electroshock therapy. Like, no, what does it make you think?
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think of, like, you know, bear, bite down on this spoon while we jack your brain with however many volts and you convulse wildly on the table. I also think people don't really remember this, I think, because it's traumatic, but that movie Return to Oz, which is very terrifying and has so much nightmare fuel in it. Little Dorothy Gale, beginning, is in like a psychiatric facility, presumably because she won't stop going on about Oz and Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And they're about to give her shock therapy when, like, there's a power outage or something and she escapes. But yeah, you think of it as being like a very barbaric, you know, relic of kind of like the age of the sanitarium or whatever, you know. But it is, you know, the Mayo Clinic has a page on it that kind of demystifies it. It is still done today under, you know, anesthetics and, you know, with much lower voltage. I'm certain not enough to make you spaz out on the table like that. But I can see exactly where the perceptions come from.
Yeah. The possibility here, or at least if someone tells you the possibility, who's like selling you this as a treatment, or is it TDCS? TCDS, transcranial, yes.
Direct simulation.
Yeah, if someone's selling you that concept of, like, look, we can pass an electrical charge through your brain, and what it's going to do, it's going to be amazing. All these positive things, strengthening all these connections, making new connections, maybe. Dude, you're going to, it's so great. And look, all you got to do is chill. It's all you got to do. It sounds amazing. It also sounds really dangerous. Is what I would say. So it's both, right? And yeah, I guess it's just, how much are you willing to risk? How much is science willing to risk if it just completely does damage to somebody? Or if it really does improve you, you're going to have to go through a lot of trials. And I don't think there's been enough trials. Maybe I'm just not up on the research.
Well, it is approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
It is.
Mm-hmm. It is. Just like cereal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there you go. Electroconvulsive therapy, as safe as what's that cereal? The only
Fruit Loops,
Raisin Bran.
You monster.
You like Raisin Bran?
I like Raisin Bran Crunch.
Mm. Okay. Oh, that's okay. All right. I'll take it right.
I feel bad. I feel like I just called Mennonite Amish or something. No, I'm sorry.
Those nut clusters is what takes it to the next level. Regular old Raisin Bran, mm-hmm. That's your grandpa's cereal right there. I'm sorry. No self-respecting millennial should be eating Raisin Bran. It's like eating grape nuts.
So good, though.
I feel like it's your mouth. It's up to you what you put in it.
That's fair.
I got your back, bro.
That's fair.
But with that being said, You're absolutely right, Amy. There is controversy behind this, and part of that controversy is inseparable from the at times troubling history of this kind of therapy, or this, I would even say, this kind of technique, because it wasn't always used in a way that would solidly be defended as therapy. And longtime listeners, you know that I of course love any chance for us to talk about real life thinking caps, TMS, TDCS. This stuff is fascinating, but like you said, Matt, there needs to be much more research done on it. And I say this as a guy who did Mad Science together, one of these transcranial direct current stimulation devices. Thankfully, I don't think I hurt myself, but we'll have to see in a few years.
Wait, was it like a metal colander with like wire leads attached to it from a car battery or something? Like, how DIY are we talking here, Ben?
Pretty MacGyver, to be honest with you. It's okay. The main reason I felt comfortable doing it, and Matt, you know all this, is because these things were in a legal gray area for a long time, and I kept trying to call companies and buy one of these things before endeavoring to build it myself. And there were all these issues, which I understand the importance of ethics and human experimentation, but I would call places and they would say, oh, okay, what institution are you with? You know, what's the paperwork on your study? I'm like, I'm with this podcast. But it's not really about that. This is just something I want to do. So the study is me. The sample size is one. I'll sign whatever you want to get rid of liability. But they had to be careful with that because even with very small amounts of current, right, even with low levels of electricity, you are messing with probably the least understood organ in the human body, right?
Very good point.
We don't know how it works. We don't know everything about how it works when it's working the way it's supposed to. But we do know that at times, historically, the use of electroconvulsive therapy, as you would call it today, has been said to have negative impacts of one sort or another. Like, Amy, what you're describing is a kind of retrograde amnesia. Right. That's one of the symptoms I think we all clocked. And according to the APA from a 2001 report, that's the American Psychiatric Association, there is some retrograde amnesia. And in some patients, the recovery from this retrograde amnesia may be incomplete. They also claim that ECT can result in persistent or permanent memory loss. But on the flip side, on the positive side, ECT has been used for cases of severe depression, like not someone just saying I'm feeling down on Twitter.
No, I mean, it's like people who are in danger of maybe self-harm or just are not able to function. It's certainly like a maybe not a last resort, but it's definitely up there. It's funny. I found a site from UT Southwestern Medical Center that reads like a laundry list of like, this is why this is great. And it's like trying to demystify it. And it definitely has some good information, but the way it's listed out, it's clearly trying to sell you on this as a treatment. They do use the word, the phrase medically triggered or medically controlled seizure. So, you know, that is what's happening. And while they might not, patients might not jerk around and convulse wildly, you know, they do jerk somewhat and there are, you know, some involuntary movements. But yeah, it's very much a thing. And it's certainly been, it's probably come a long way, but has it though? It's like, I mean, how it doesn't get much more basic than, okay, we're going to shoot some electricity into your brain. Like, we've known how to generate varying degrees of electricity for a long time. I wonder what specifically is different other than the fact that they're putting you to sleep.
It's not a bad question. So a big part of it is the location, like what section of the brain is receiving this stimulation. And then also another thing, because I clocked Southwestern as well. Another thing that has evolved that's similar to ECT is MST, which is the short for magnetic seizure therapy. You can see why doctors probably want to call this MST instead of
magnets, dude. Magnets. Yeah.
Magnets, you know.
How do they work?
Someone figured it out. But these treatments can be important. They can have measurable positive impact, but we have to remember, again, nothing occurs in a vacuum. And the entire time that people were looking into the use of ECT as a treatment for depression in specific, we have to remember there was an entirely different field of experts that were researching antidepressants. And as antidepressants evolved, they became an increasingly viable alternative.
Profitable.
Actually, yeah, let's flip that. You're right. They became an increasingly profitable and then viable alternative to treatments for depression. With this in mind, when we think about these kind of experiments, first, we have to be really clear that we're not doctors. This is not medical advice. But when you are intentionally triggering a seizure in the brain, which is what is happening with this therapy, the entire point of it is to cause changes in brain chemistry that can reverse symptoms of certain medical conditions. And that last clause of what I just said, cause changes in brain chemistry that can reverse symptoms of certain mental conditions, the question is, would you shock yourself in an attempt at wellness if you could simply take a pill? Also, on the profit motive, ECT treatment is recommended in like reps of 10 to 15, like 10 right. to 15 sessions.
I'm sure those sessions aren't cheap.
Mm-hmm. And antidepressants are something you have to take on a regular basis. You don't get 15 pills of Lexapro and then you're better forever.
No, right? it's true. I got to say that in hearing you describe that, Ben, just now, it makes me think of like, this is sort of the psychiatric equivalent of like banging the side of the TV when it's like glitching out, you know, in the hopes that your banging will trigger the right thing among all the other wrong things that it could also trigger. And if you do it enough times, maybe you'll get it to where the picture is like, you know, tracking correctly again. Because it sure seems like a blunt instrument type, you know, process to me.
Yeah, but in this case, you're, it's, I don't know, with a TV, it's like you're adding an additional electrical plug to your television besides okay. the primary one. And then you plug that one in too, just to see what happens if a little extra electricity.
Just for a second. You know what I mean? Like, how did you sell that idea in the early days? You're just like, you know what's amazing? Electricity. I'm just saying, what are you guys doing this weekend?
You've seen all these famous experiments where we, you know, electrocute a elephant until it dies. Mm-hmm. You've seen them. Hey, let's try it on some humans. How about you?
Just for a second. I can't emphasize how much I want that recap to really have somebody who's saying just for a second over and over again. Like right as they're plugging the person in, they're like, okay, one sec. Oh, yeah, we lost them. That's why, you know, to your point, it is intentionally causing seizures. And a lot of the controversy around it is whether this is responsible use, whether the benefits outweigh the possible risk. And that historical image just doesn't look good, because in the earlier days, patients/victims were not given anesthetics. So they were actively seizing, if you can see me shaking around. And I'm not making light of this. This could result in fractured bones, memory loss, a rogue's gallery of other potentially harmful side effects. But right now, it might surprise some folks to know that ECT can be recommended because some people, for one reason or another, cannot take an antidepressant. Mm. It's actually, this surprised me, might surprise you too, Amy. ECT has been specifically recommended for pregnant patients because, you know, you have to be very careful with what you ingest, right? If you're expecting, because it will affect the child.
Yeah, but your brain is,
right?
Is making all of those involuntary processes happen.
That's the thing. That's like, I would recommend getting a second opinion.
Does amniotic fluid conduct electricity? One would think, I don't know. I mean, I know they're different regions, but still, really? that just seems way off.
And then also for maybe older adults who cannot tolerate certain side effects of drugs. Like what we're seeing is right now the establishment considers ECT controversial, but they believe it does have efficacy in certain situations. This is a topic that's endlessly fascinating on a personal level, I think, to a lot of us. We may end up diving into this in the future in a full episode. But for now, what we would say is, Amy, first off, congratulations. Thank you for writing this fantastic letter, and so glad to hear that you are doing well. We want to make sure anybody who's hearing this who has considered treatments like these or considered shooting electricity into your brain, take it from me, folks. I know it sounds really cool. I am on board with it in the realest way. I am 10 toes down on this, but learn from my mistakes. Don't MacGyver stuff. You can buy those kits if you're really interested now. I think the laws have loosened a little bit. But if you are messing with forces, you don't really understand, and no one really understands the human brain, get an expert. Get an expert to help you through that process and advise you on whether or not you need to consider it in the first place.
They still use those big, like, suction cup things that go on your temples, or are they advanced past that?
I've seen ones that are more netting. It kind of are expandable, mm-hmm. and it kind of fits on your brain, on your head, and the little skull ears.
I just picture the torture scene in Princess Bride.
Also true.
You guys remember that?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it didn't work out so well, right?
Well, he was mostly dead.
It's the machine that's supposed to, like, take a year off his life with every twist of the crank.
By making him listen to water or something.
It was weird. It wasn't clear how that machine actually worked, but you're right. He did have some electrode-y type things on his noggin there.
What a good story. So we ended on that note, but please, if you have experience with this as a positive or negative, we would love to hear from you. As always, you can drop us a line directly. We'll tell you how to do that again at the end of the show. But for now, let's take a break for a word from our sponsor, who I don't think will be a TDCS device, but if so, let the chips fall as they will. We'll be back.
And here's more from Kenmore Microwaves. Don't take them apart like Ben did.
Should have never told you that story.
All right, and we're back. And we're going to wrap today's episode up with kind of a fun one. It's a callback to a previous fun email we got about haunted, and relating to our haunted objects episode. I think y'all will remember this, especially if you're on the Here's Where It Gets Crazy Facebook group, because I believe a really clever listener made a, like, movie poster about the blue ball. It was like a horror movie kind of poster situation. Yeah, I believe it had a tag. Eric, thanks, Ben. You're the best with remembering names. I remembered the piece and I loved it. What was the tagline? It was like, it's time to play with your balls or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Poetry.
It was good. It was, and I'm sure one of us actually said that because we're children. But that was a fun one because it was definitely like, it had that Are You Afraid of the Dark kind of vibe where it's kind of innocuous and a little bit, you know, corny, but then it does kind of get you in the end where, and then of course it came for one last appearance. And then, you know, when you hear stories like that about haunted objects or something that seemed just too crazy to be coincidence, you usually find a way to justify it or explain it away with a coincidence. Or Matt, I believe your idea was that it was a pack of these balls that had been purchased in one go, and they just kind of, you know, found their way back into, you know, circulation, I guess. Even after one of them was thrown away, there was another one lurking in a hamper somewhere, and it just ends up rolling along like balls do. A listener named Cassandra wrote in with an alternate theory that brings up a concept that I was not aware of, but it definitely is present in plenty of, like, pop culture and stuff. Something called resistentialism. The long version of it being counter phenomenological resistentialism. We'll get to what that is in a minute, but here's the email. Greetings, Ben, Matt, and Noel. While you recounted the story of a certain potentially haunted object and discussed your theories of what could have been causing this ball to seemingly keep reappearing, you also posed the question as to what the ball's intentions may have been. Did it want to play, or was it intent on tripping someone? This brought to mind a term I learned several years ago. Here it is again. See if I can do it. Counter-phenomenological resistentialism, or just resistentialism. It refers to the possibility or belief that inanimate objects have minds of their own and innately dislike people. Yeah, which I just love. I no longer have the book I read about this, and I think it was called Weird, Scary, and Unusual Stories and Facts. But as I recall, it gave examples as to what else this phenomenon might explain, including someone, quote, losing their keys. Been there. A bouncy ball bouncing out of control, and the continuous disappearance of spoons from a certain institution or hospital. I believe it said there was actually a study done at the institution tracking its mysterious and repetitious decline in utensils. This is true. We're going to get to that. While I'm not exactly a believer in counter-phenomenological resistentialism myself, I find it an interesting idea and a fun term I thought you might like to know if you didn't already. Thank you for all the work and effort you do on the excellent show and for keeping us informed on so many topics they would rather we be kept in the dark about. Cassandra. And then she says to feel free to use her name. So we did, because I like the name Cassandra a lot. Ben, you're familiar with this concept.
And they being spoons, by the way. The spoons.
Exactly. So socks, you kitchen utensils, you know, T-shirts, so many little things like that I just feel like everyone has this shared experience of constantly being, you know, diminishing supply of these things over time. Easy to explain away to just, well, they're not that big a deal. Spoons, you might just take one with you for a picnic and leave it. No one really cares that much, but I still think it's a little bit ridiculous to the degree to which I lose utensils. Ben, what was your experience with this concept and what do you associate it with?
So first we have to consider that to many people, this idea is a thought experiment or a little bit purposely tongue-in-cheek. You know what I mean? But it builds on, just like Rennell's earlier story about folklore and fae in the U.S., the idea of this concept, resistentialism, builds on the very old concepts that are kind of like animism. The idea that objects, like humans, may have some sort of soul or sentience or their own background palette of motivations and fears and desires. This is a very, very old concept. It's one of, I would argue, it is one of the first things humans did that's kind of like a religion, you know, and it's still with us today. Like a lot of people don't think of this as a religious act, but do you guys name your stuff? We all know someone who names a car, right?
Sure, yeah.
And so animism is the belief that there's a multitude, an innumerable multitude of spiritual beings somehow concerned with human affairs. And just like the fae, they can hurt you, they can harm you, and you can't always trust them to be consistent in that regard. So the big difference here, I think is fascinating, Cassandra, is that in the idea that we're positing, resistentialism, this idea is like a very pessimistic version of object-based animism.
Right. It makes me think of like a lot of stuff from, you know, literature and pop culture, like Winnie the Pooh, or for example, like the idea that toys have a life, you know, or the Velveteen Rabbit. There is another story I remember very distinctly from when I was a kid that was clearly what Toy Story was based on. I can't remember what it was called. But it was about the old school toy being supplanted by the new shiny toy that's like a spaceman or like a acrobat or something like that. I'm sure it's a trope that has been repeated throughout history because we have this innate need or desire anyway to anthropomorphize animals and objects and the idea that things have personality. But I'm with you, Ben, that it is more of a thought experiment. I don't think anyone's actually saying your spoons are dematerializing and showing up on another planet or something.
Oh, right? Matt's got one.
I'm just going to put this out there.
Oh, boy.
One of the most intelligent people that I've ever met and interesting, talented, was a former boss of ours, and she put into our heads, my head, the concept, whether she was being serious or not, the concept that if I treated my computer and my electronics well, if I talked to them, if I comforted them when they were having an issue, they would perform better and they would not have so many issues with their software. If I was kind to them, if I put them away gently, if I made sure they were always clean. And I swear to you, I will not say that I fully believe this, but I will say that I somehow, in doing these little rituals of making sure my machine was always taken care of well, I felt like things were going better with me and my computer, but as a relationship, you know?
But Matt, doesn't that also mean that you, like, back when you had to do this, made sure to always defrag your hard drive and, like, don't keep your desktop too cluttered because you have this certain respect that you bring to the situation that maybe feels like a ritual to you, but it also translates to functional acts of maintenance that you're doing that some people might just let go? Because the biggest thing that causes computers to slow down is when people don't realize their hard drives are almost completely full, and then they start to, like, you know, log jam the whole system. So I think it was a good piece of advice, because I think it just, you treated it with respect and you gave it its due, and you, you know, oiled it when it needed to be oiled. I'm now changing it to a Tin Man kind of situation.
It's true, Noel. Matt and I had the same boss, Roxanne, if you're listening, you're amazing. Awesome. And she really believed it, Matt. You know, she told both of us the same thing, and I've done it before too, but it's almost, you could argue, you know, like, Noel, I think you raise a very good point. If you feel like you have a personal relationship with a thing, you are more likely to treat it with empathy and do, like, picture it liking stuff you do. That's also another way to, during the pandemic, I think we all experienced a little bit more anthropomorphization than we had maybe bargained for.
Yeah, because right? All of a sudden our computer has the faces of all of our disembodied friends on it. Ooh. And it's literally the only contact we have with, like, humanity.
Yeah, well, like, look at this. Like, here's another one for people, even, you know, we're talking to the skeptics here, right? And I'm with you guys. Like, Matt got in my head too. I also talk to objects and I name them. You know, I think you only have to worry if they start talking back. But
it is kind of comforting.
It is. You know what
at
I
least
mean?
Someone's when, talking to me.
Right. When my machete's like, whoo, you're getting out there. Then I'm like, yeah, good call, Mark. But the thing I noticed, and I want to hear from our friends listening today, animate or inanimate objects. I noticed that I was anthropomorphizing a ton of stuff in my kitchen. And I think this is universal. I realized I have one spoon that I think of as, like, the bad spoon. And I can't explain it. I'm just like, it knows what it did. It's up to something. It's the bad spoon. I haven't thrown it away. I'm at an impasse.
That's definitely, don't throw it away. That's the worst thing you could do.
You don't want to put that bad energy out into the world, man, because then it's on you. But it's so funny, like, the whole you're being nice to your computer thing. Plants are living things, but I still think of them kind of as inanimate objects, right? A lot of people talk to plants and they say that makes them grow better.
Watch out. Doc and I both, I think, have strong feelings on this. I do believe that plants will tend to have a better life if you're talking to them. And maybe it's just like what you're saying, Noel. Maybe it's because you're interacting on that level, you're more likely to water it. You're more likely to be aware of health conditions in the plant. But also, you know, maybe they're just lonely. It's not like they can go places.
How long does one of these conversations last is what I want to know. Like, is this sufficient for me to just say, hey, buddy, looking good?
Hey, no comment is fine, Ben.
Right. Okay.
No, I just mean for my purposes. How do I get started talking to plants? That's my question. Because I'm not joking when I say, yeah, I really do want to be a good plant dad, and I've done pretty well. Mm. But, like, I sometimes overwater them, and that is just as bad as underwatering them. It sort of speaks to my character. Sometimes I just insist upon myself. I just need to really nurture things until they just, like, crush them. You know, I'm kidding. But how do I get started with my plant interaction?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know, Matt. Sounds like we're doing a little relationship advice.
All right. So this is what we're going to do, Noel. We're going to set up a tiny mirror near the plant, and you're going to make eye contact with yourself, and you're going to hold a little therapy session, except for instead of referring to you as you or me or Noel, you're just going to talk to the plant, and plant's name is going to be Sam. And you're going to say, yeah, that the plant is your father, and you're going to, so you will be the son of Sam.
But I hate my father. I mean, does that mean I have to punch the plant?
The plant will talk back to you.
Okay.
Give you very specific instructions.
I don't really hate my father.
Sorry.
No, I love this. I love this idea. I do have a plant named Nigel that I have named. So I'm on my way with this whole idea. But the resistentialism is, like you said, Ben, the kind of very cranky, pessimistic alter ego of this idea of talking to your plants and they'll be nice to you, or right, talking to your computer and it'll, you know, not break. Because this posits that objects of all kinds hate us and want to do us harm, or at the very least inconvenience us by disappearing spontaneously.
Well,
because we use them all the time.
Yeah, we're just users.
And what do they
we take
get?
And we take. But also, we're look how the human species treats itself. You know, it treats objects in order of magnitude worse. We are discussing this to the utmost of our ability, Cassandra, but I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't point out the etymology of this term. When we say it's a thought experiment, when we say it's a little tongue-in-cheek, it was invented or coined by a humorist named Paul Jennings. It's a British writer. It's kind of like a Louis Grizzard of his day, for anybody who remembers Louis Grizzard, or... Oh, what's that other guy? He's got a sister. I'm so bad at this.
Oh, he's Sedaris?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
David.
Yeah, nice. Nice one. Okay. I was the guy who went into Blockbuster. I was like, you know, I'm looking for that movie. There's music in it,
I think. You know, that guy with the face and the good hair.
Yeah,
the guy with the good hair.
Oh, yeah, High Fidelity.
Wow. Matt, you really nailed it.
How is are that, you not that, the manager of this
John
Blockbuster?
Cusack did have a nice face and nice hair. I alluded to it but didn't mention it, and we're running long. I just want to just let everyone know there was a study that looked at teaspoons specifically, I believe, in Melbourne, Australia, at a research institute, a facility. And they, like, they gave them a half-life score, these teaspoons, depending on where they originated, whether it was in a common area or an area that was more like devoted to a particular branch of research. And I think you guys should just go look into that yourselves. This would be some good supplemental reading, because I think we've said our piece. The takeaway is that, yeah, a lot of teaspoons disappear. No one copped in the office to fully removing the teaspoons from the building. So the jury is out as to what happened. There were a few errant teaspoons that were found on desktops and, you know, squirreled away somewhere, maybe some like hoarders or something. But there were an ungodly amount of teaspoons that went missing. And when they applied that statistic to like the larger, you know, United Kingdom, it was staggering number. It was, you know, millions and millions of teaspoons going missing each year.
You know, I bet it was. I bet it was a capuchin in one of the ventilation shafts.
Yeah.
You've seen it before. I've seen it before. Everybody has.
Isn't that the ending to a Sherlock Holmes story or something, where it was a monkey with a razor the whole time stealing all the teaspoons?
It's almost always.
I think it was a reference to Community.
Yeah. Annie's, you know, that's the name of the monkey.
Oh yeah,
that's right. But yeah, I am on board. You know, Noel, I'm fascinated by studies like this. Also, I am gonna profile, and I feel like my spoon is responsible. It is the subject of a horror movie, Bad Spoon. Right? It's quiet in the kitchen.
Let's do it.
Too quiet.
It's like the bad seed.
Yes,
now, but the bad spoon. And I, just in case anyone wants to Google it and look a little further, the study was done at a place called BMJ. This is not helping me. I need what the B and the M and the J actually stand for.
The British Medical Journal.
That's it. The British Medical Journal, which claims on its website anyway to be the leading medical research, news, education, opinion, and some other stuff in the United Kingdom.
No, I literally just said British Medical Journal off the top of my head. I'm sorry, dude. I didn't know that was real. Okay.
Well, it was super helpful, Matt, because it totally is real. And as I was saying before, they fancy themselves to be they have quite a high opinion of themselves, and they are ranked pretty highly by the journal What Ranks Journals. So good on them.
The Journal of Journalistic Hierarchies.
Exactly. You know the one.
Yeah, but, I love it.
I think this is a great place to leave off today. This was a fun, like you said, Ben, thought experiment to go through. But thanks, Cassandra, for the email. And I love the concept. It's going to give me some interesting dreams tonight, I think.
And if you are interested in reading more Tori Story-esque adventures, highly recommend the comic book series, The Stuff of Legend. It's awesome. I have no notes on it. Just check it out. Let us know what you think. Also, let me know when they finally sew it up. I've got to stop falling in love with comic book series that have not ended. It is the worst. But while we're, I know, Black Monday Murders. Sorry, Matt. But while we're waiting for those to come out, we cannot wait to hear from you. Give us something else to read. While we're waiting for Black Monday Murders, The Stuff of Legend, Uber Invasion, and all those other great reads to finally finish their stories. Cassandra, Amy, Rennell, everybody who has wrote in and called, as always, thank you for tuning in. We cannot wait to hear from you. Let us know your thoughts on your fellow listeners' stories. We'd love your firsthand accounts of folklore. We'd love your firsthand experiences with ECT. And we'd love to know if you have a piece of cutlery that resents you. We're easy to find online.
It can even be spoonlery, whatever you want it to be.
Spoonlery, yes.
You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're Conspiracy Stuff. We are Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. Ben, how do you feel about Nightwing?
Nightwing?
Yeah.
Are we talking comics, Matt?
We're talking comics, Nightwing.
Oh, yeah. I dug it. Just for a second, I was thinking of Shadowhawk, which is a different one. But Nightwing used to be Robin, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Any thoughts on Nightwing?
Doesn't he use like a billy club or something? He seems like a fascist to me. I don't know. He has like kind of a like a pole that he whacks people. Maybe I'm just thinking of the word nightstick.
No, you're right. He has batons.
He does have batons. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I will be completely honest. Not everybody agrees with me on this. I have a hard time with some characters like that because they are not superpowered, right? He doesn't have the superpower billions of dollars like Bruce Wayne does. He's a human who trains very hard, has a work ethic and an ideology. And I'm trying not to ding on it, but at some point in some comics, I've been reading them and I've been thinking, okay, you're all just people though.
Well, maybe that's what's so inspiring about Nightwing, man. He's just a person that he grew up with a family in the circus, and he's got all these skills, and now he's got to, you know, do better for his family.
Okay. What brings Nightwing to your mind?
Oh, nothing. It's a conversation for another time.
Quick one before we go. How do you feel about Darkwing Duck?
Oh,
let's Come get on. Dangerous.
You guys are making me sound like a jerk. I was watching him, and I was like, you're a... You know, like, do you have super duck powers? I was trying to figure out what his powers were.
He has a grappling hook of some sort.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Isn't he a millionaire? Doesn't he play like, isn't his alter ego like a rich guy? I can't remember.
Oh, you're right.
Is it Scrooge in disguise?
No, it's Darkwing. I forget what it is. Mallard? Some duck joke.
Is Shere Khan the bad guy in that one?
I believe he is at some point, but there's a lot of different
ones. The tiger?
Yeah. Shere Khan's the business. I get it. I get where he's coming from.
Yeah. Oh, Darkwing, man, what is ducks? This? Where,
I can't believe I got it right.
Ended up.
I can't believe I got it right. His name is Drake Mallard, and he is presumably very wealthy.
Wouldn't that be like Jeff Bezos having the last name Person?
Totally would be.
Jeff Person.
Very on the nose.
Hello, I am Jeff Person.
Mark Personberg. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, we got to stop this.
We got an email address or something, right?
Oh, and Doc says, or Jeff Douchebag. Oh, thanks, Alexis.
Wouldn't back me up on the plant conversation, Doc, but came in hard on some Jeff roasting. So send your best Jeff Bezos roast to us, where Matt mentioned before. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the rest. If you do not care for social media, then we totally get it. Go ahead and give us a call directly. We have a phone number.
That's right. You can reach us at 1-833-STDWYTK. Leave a message at the sound of Ben's dulcet tones. 3 minutes is the time you shall have to tell your tale. Let us know if it's okay to use your name on the air, and we likely will include it in one of our weekly listener mail episodes, which we just wrapped one. So like that, it'll be like what we just did. So make it good.
Yeah. Also, remember to find us on YouTube, where we are Conspiracy Stuff. Pretty easy. Also, leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. That would be great. I'm not saying give us 5 stars. I'm just saying that helps. It would be cool. We'd love it. But you rate us however you want to rate us. 5 stars. Okay, so if you don't want to do any of that stuff, you don't want to call, you don't want to find us on social, you don't want to rate us, you can always still reach us via our old-fashioned email address. We are
badspoon@iheartradio.com. Kidding, conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Bad Spoon.
I'm the bad spoon. Duh.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.